The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 24th of July, 2020. On the podcast today, George McDonough, Managing Director and Co-Founder at KR1 PLC. And George provides a portfolio update on Nexus Mutual, which they've done very well on. He also discusses other parts of the business and Bitcoin, of course. Plus, Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about the amount of fundraising that's occurred lately and its significance. Also, Paul Hill, full-time investor and equity analyst, talks about news from Tristel, Blanco Technology Group and VP PLC. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs too. You can see both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk. In fact, the top 10 versions there, right there. Plus, you'll see lots of other content. There's a video there from Robert Ross of Expediator. There's a blog post there from Fran talking about IMI. There's also one on Centrica. Of course, they've share price has jumped up. I've talked with Russ on the podcast there, due to them selling one of their US businesses for $3.6 billion. There's an article on Hotel Chocolat, plus much, much more. And, of course, there's a COVID-19 index we've got there. Check that out. Biggest rise of the day is Synergen. Wow. Done about 400% this week. Star of the week, SNG. It's up 8% or 7.5% a day, £2.01. Biggest faller, Tech Capital, down 10% to 9 pence. Check that out, voxmarkets.co.uk. And I'll be back after this.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is George McDonough, Managing Director and Co-Founder at KR1. George, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, you've released a good bit of news there on one of your investments, early investments, and we'll talk about that and what you're up to at the moment. But before we do, as always, if someone's never heard of KR1, just summarise what it's about, please, George.
Sure, yeah. So KR1 is an early stage blockchain and digital investment company. And I guess what we do is we give investors access to the crypto economy via a publicly listed share. So our focus is, you know, so the usual suspects like, you know, Bitcoin, Ethereum, the DeFi markets that have grown out of Ethereum, and we, as well as sort of sourcing deals on the sort of the cutting edge of the technology, like interchain protocols and privacy networks. And we were one of the first institutional investors in the space, starting back in early 2016. So over that time, we've built up a really great portfolio of assets and also a network that allows us access to these new projects, and obviously a good track record of investment in the space.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, how many investments do you hold at the moment, George?
I think it's circa around 38. I should qualify the fact that investing in digital assets isn't the same as investing in equity. We have what you might call a fast turnaround, not in the sense that we're moving out of projects quickly. What happens is that we get our investment capital back fairly quickly because of the way the crypto markets work, which means we can take that money and go again, as it were, and reinvest that. So it's kind of VC on speed, you could call it. It really moves fast, and hence why we managed to get involved in so many projects.
Yeah, and talk about getting your capital back plus some. So the news, you did a portfolio update on Nexus Mutual. Take us through what's happened here.
Yeah, so Nexus was an early investment of ours. Part of the emerging ecosystem back in 2017 was the beginning of what we now call DeFi, which is decentralized finance applications built on Ethereum. And the very heart of these projects are things called smart contracts, which are effectively sort of decentralized packets of code on the Ethereum blockchain that process the ability for these applications to work. And we thought, and indeed saw back in the early days, that sometimes these coded smart contracts don't work the way one would hope they do. And we have obviously seen over the years instances where, you know, money's been lost or the functioning of these applications hasn't gone to plan. So Nexus Mutual allows is a sort of cover mutual. It's a way by which the community can come together and get cover over the malfunctioning of these smart contracts. Mm-hmm. And we've obviously felt that that was, you know, of critical importance, considering how early the space was in being able to understand how these smart contracts worked. And so we made a very early seed investment into Nexus Mutual. We were the first money in. And then obviously, you know, 2018 happened, and they went on quite a, you know, up and down journey over the years. But obviously DeFi has grown since then, and wonderfully Nexus Mutual has become the sort of the very sort of heart of it, in terms of people getting cover for this myriad of applications. So what did we do? We bought tokens at $2.24, and then last week we managed to sell a portion of those tokens for $14 a token, netting the company $492,000.
Wow. Which is a fantastic. Nice return. $2.24, you bought them for and sold them for $14.03. That's a nice return, isn't it?
Fantastic for us. It gives us obviously it validates the investment decision back then, but it also gives us you know, more firepower to go again.
Yeah, and I suppose it's I don't know what the saying is, the entire saying, but on some early investments like that and cutting edge investments, so they've got a lot of hype around them. You've got to be early, you know. If you're early, you can do well, and you can afford to, even if the project doesn't, you know, reach its fruition, as long as you're in early, you can get out early with your capital back, and you've not lost anything, have you?
Well, yeah, that's right. I think you know, so much of the value that, you know, KR1 can bring to shareholders is our network and our ability to get access to projects just literally at the sort of gestation phase. Mm-hmm. And as long as you have a wide enough understanding of where the space is going, you can begin to back projects that you know, end up being incredibly important, you know, 2-3 years down the line. And I think we've shown time after time that we've done that. And Nexus is another example where, you know, we just knew that covering smart contracts was going to be a major piece of the puzzle, and thankfully Hugh Karp and his team, who've worked very, very hard over these last few years to bring it to market, you know, can now you know, enjoy the fact that they're right at the heart of things.
Yeah, what's general thoughts at the moment? Bitcoin is in a strange place at the moment, isn't it? It's really just almost flat, just trading sideways. And you've got to think, you know, sooner or later, a breakout's going to happen. And what's your thoughts?
Yeah, it is. You're absolutely right. It is at a very exciting stage. It's you know, a key level of resistance where we are. And it's tried a number of times to break through and failed. But it hasn't gone back down considerably. It's sat right at the resistance level for, as you say, a long period of time. Mm. And the longer it stays there, the more exciting it gets, really. In terms of you know, the potential for it to break through. Mm-hmm. But really, I mean, that's all happening in the background. Obviously, the, you know, Bitcoin is the bellwether in terms of the crypto markets. But what's happening on Ethereum and the DeFi you know, ecosystem is really exciting. We're seeing huge volumes moving through that blockchain and that ecosystem, and for us, it's very much, you know, all eyes on Ethereum.
Yeah. And so you've been doing this for how long? Have you been doing this for now?
4 years. Yeah, early 2016 we started.
Yeah. Do you find? I mean, with me, I've been investing for over 20 years, I'd say. I started off before the dot-com happened, but I'm still learning every day. And you must feel that the same, especially in a new space still, where crypto is. You're learning with every investment, are you?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. The space is truly extraordinary how fast it moves. I think it's testament to the fact that, you know, what's been discovered is, you know, digital scarcity and programmable money. And the technology that we can build up around these really core sort of foundational inventions almost knows no bounds. It kind of moves outwards into really all verticals. There's so much promise and potential as it does so. And what we're trying to do is trying to, you know, look over the space, look over the ecosystem, and pick the areas and the projects that are going to, you know, really, really stand out and show the power of this technology for what it is. And currently, decentralized finance, or DeFi, is that sort of perfect product market fit. But it'll move into other areas as well, and is already doing so, like, you know, privacy and various other avenues. So absolutely, I couldn't imagine a more exciting area to invest in, really.
Is it one investment at the moment you're quite excited about? Normally with me, it's my latest investment, you know, because otherwise you wouldn't invest in it. Unless you thought it had more excitement and more potential than the last one, you wouldn't really invest in it, I suppose. But name one investment you're particularly excited about.
Well, for us, of course, you know, it has to be Polkadot, really. Mm-hmm. Polkadot was the largest investment we made as a company 2.5 years ago. What Polkadot promises is this sort of new era of interchain connectivity. So currently all the blockchains are sort of siloed, doing their own thing and in some ways competing with each other. And what Polkadot aims to do is actually connect all these blockchains together so that messages and data can move amongst chains, basically, you know, making the space that much more interoperable and that much bigger. And it's been a long wait, but it's really right now going through its kind of very last phases of launch. So we have a mainnet chain; it's working. All the validators who are validating their tokens are doing that work. And what we're waiting for now is what's called token transferability. So the community will vote to allow the DOT tokens to move. And at that point, well, then we'll see the token, you know, hit the exchanges. And there's a huge amount of excitement in the market generally to see how this evolution of blockchain takes place, basically. So we're really excited about that.
Cool stuff. Excellent. And has there been any sort of news of late, just generally, of adoption of maybe cryptocurrencies from maybe, you know, traditional or investors or institutions?
Sure.
That has excited you, that thought, oh, okay, here we go, there's a step change in maybe going from mainstream. What's your thoughts?
Well, the big news just recently was the regulators in the US allowing banks to custody crypto. So you know, whereas, you know, you've had to have, you know, sort of grassroots custodians, you know, grow out of the space in order to allow institutions to custody their crypto, now banks can come to the table too with all of their brands that they've built and their trust and so on and so forth. So that's really a huge potentially a huge sign that, you know, the legacy world, as you call it, is coming to play a bit more. And over and above that, I'd say actually the letter that the Tudor investment company wrote, so Paul Tudor Jones, where he said that he'd allocate just under 2% of his portfolio towards Bitcoin as a hedge against inflation, in terms of all the central bank printing that's going on, that was a huge watershed moment as well for the space, because it showed that some of the world's biggest traders were looking at Bitcoin as the Bitcoin narrative said it would, which is as a safe haven asset. And so that as well has been a huge moment for us.
Yeah, exactly. And I saw that interview, and when you get someone of his stature, if people don't know Paul Tudor Jones, it's worth looking up. But he's regarded as a legend. He's he's a billionaire hedge fund manager. So when he lends his weight and his opinion in favor of Bitcoin, it says a lot, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Like I say, it kind of corroborates the underlying narrative of Bitcoin. And obviously, what with COVID-19 and the changes that have happened throughout the markets, and in terms of how central banks are behaving, really the backdrop for Bitcoin now is yeah, really interesting, I think we're going to see it react rather in the same way that gold has reacted. It's interesting times.
Yeah, no, do you know what? I was surprised how young he was. Really, he's 65, and he's worth close to $6 billion. Sometimes you see these people, they're not there, and I just thought he's a lot older because people call him legend all the time. And you think, how did these people make so much money in one lifetime? It's like Jeff Bezos, it's phenomenal. How do they make so much money in one lifetime? But there you go. George, three final things then. If someone's listening right now and likes the sound of KR1 but are not yet following you, give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, I think if you want access to the crypto economy, the easy way, via a publicly listed share. We follow the markets and our portfolio captures the markets, very well. So that would be one reason. Another reason, of course, is that, if you're UK based, you can put our shares in an ISA, which is very interesting in terms of the volatility of crypto. When the good times are good, it's very good. Having access to crypto in a, tax wrapper is certainly very interesting. And also, we're a very unique crypto company because of the transparency that we have being publicly listed. You can see everything that we buy and sell, through our blog as well, you can see how we think and what we do. So we're easy to follow in that respect, which isn't always the case in the wider crypto VC/fund space. So those would be three reasons to follow.
Marvelous stuff. George, thanks for joining us, and hopefully we'll speak soon. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me on.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell, and I've got to say, spreadsheet specialist, Ninja.
Oh, you absolute flatterer. Thank you very much indeed. I was just saving something and just opening something when you rang. But no, I do, I'm afraid to say, even as a history graduate, think in spreadsheets now, which is not necessarily a good thing, but it helps with my job, but whether it helps in other ways is another matter entirely. I'm not the sort of person that lines up his Coca-Cola cans so they're all facing the right way, I hasten to add.
No, but do you know what? They are quite addictive spreadsheets. When you start getting into them and you start cracking certain formulas you can do, and it's so easy to just copy and paste and think, I can do so much with this. You can break down everything.
It makes you think about the numbers and what's actually in them. Yes, very much so.
And you can always, listen, certain stocks, of course, you can't value every stock like for like, because some have different end markets, some are more hyped than others or highly valued than others. But you can always come back to the basics, can't you? Think, okay, well, this is what they're worth, the net asset value, this is what they've grown by last year. Yeah, so it's all very interesting. It's always good to have a background, a depth, a foundation in that, in the fundamentals. Cool. All right, so talking about,
just talk about fundraising.
There's been a heck of a lot, hasn't there?
There has. And only really triggered me, but this is a separate, just because before Centrica here on Friday has announced the unexpected disposal of its US business for over £3 billion, which effectively wipes out the company's net debt if it chooses to do that.
And
the shares are up 25%.
Yes. You've enlightened me, sure. I'm not familiar with Centrica. I know it's not been doing very well.
It's been a shambles.
For the last how many years? I know the share price has been down.
Think of a number.
Yeah, when you just think it can't go any further down to the right, it goes down right another 12 months. But I looked at that and I thought, hang on, they're selling that. That makes a lot of sense. I didn't think of it. They're selling this for $3.625 billion.
And they've got 2.8 of debt.
Yeah, all right. And I was looking at their market cap. I thought, well, they need 2.7. That should double their share price. And then I realised they've they've got that in debt, so that makes sense why they haven't got.
But they also have pension liabilities as well.
So that's the drag,
again, which would pop up in your spreadsheet. You see, when you're looking at things in greater debt.
So it's filled a bit of a hole then, basically.
And in the end, you know, very simply put, less debt means less risk.
Yeah.
Less risk means a higher multiple of earnings and therefore a higher share price. And it's really, in that respect, fairly elemental. Yeah. And I think the fact that new boss Chris O'Shea has taken an unexpected and dramatic step, I think, you know, as after a period of time when there have been multiple profit warnings, multiple dividend cuts and all sorts of other difficult and operational missteps, and actually postponed disposals, they're still looking to sell Spirit Energy, their UK exploration and production business, and also their nuclear activities. So there could be more cash coming into the kitty. Maybe this is, you know, the first step for the company to get back on the front foot. And also, in fairness, UK customer numbers only fell by 1% year on year, which is pretty good going compared to what you've seen recently. So cash, you know, that's one way of raising funds, is selling assets. BP's been doing it. Shell's looking to do it. The other ways is obviously you come to your shareholders, or you launch an open offer and a placing and say, okay, what do you think? And I think just looking at the numbers we've had, or certainly looking at the London Stock Exchange's data, to the end of June, we've had £17 billion of secondary raisings this year from UK quoted and UK listed companies. That's pretty much what we saw in each and every year, 16, 17, 18 and 19. So we're halfway through the year and the same amount of money has been raised already. And again, I guess the question is now, does that continue? And if so, does it stop the stock market going up? Because there isn't much primary, i.e. initial public offering activity right now at all. I think barely £1 billion, which is an absolutely teeny figure compared to what we used to. I mean, I've got the numbers of going back to 2000 here in front of me, and that only $1.9 billion was raised in 2009. Fag end of the great financial crisis, share prices were low, so valuations probably weren't up, were certainly what the sellers were looking for, at least. And we're going to find it quite hard work to catch up with that at the moment. But the secondary activity is very high. And I guess that's companies effectively, in many cases, I think, looking to just copper bottom balance sheets, prove to shareholders, look, we can get through this. And in some cases, you've had companies like Whitbread, Premier Inn owner, copper bottoming the balance sheet, but also saying, look, this might give us a bit of a war chest here. We've got one or two rivals in trouble. We can get out on the front foot and grab some market share. But I think the major reason is companies just looking to say, we can get through this with your help. Thank you very much indeed. And again, you know, the biggest challenge for firms is can they pay their bills? The government's giving them help with some. They can't necessarily give them interest help with their interest bill, although that's an interesting separate debate. But the banks, so far, I think, have been pretty flexible in terms of waiving covenants, giving people time. But fundraisings, so the question is now, does it continue and does it stop the market? Well, it certainly didn't stop the UK market rising in 2010, 11, 12, 13. But I think you will see more fundraisings, A, because the longer the pandemic rattles around, the slower the economic upturn could be. But, you know, and some, you know, that could therefore pressure cash flows. And if you, as and when you do get a relatively robust upturn, you often find, particularly with manufacturers, that they need more working capital as they come out of the recession, because they start rebuilding inventory. So that stuff sat on shelves, either in their factory or at customers, for which they're waiting to get paid. So that's cash out in the short term. So you often see companies need more working cap and more cash coming out of the downturn than you see going in. So I wouldn't be in the least bit surprised if there was to be more placings, accelerated book builds, open offers, subscriptions, whatever, you know, whatever mechanism is chosen. But it doesn't necessarily mean, thankfully, that it's going to stop the equity market in its tracks. The other thing that this does reverse, of course, is that there was that one of the most awful neologisms I've ever heard, de-equitization.
Yeah.
Which meant that companies were returning more money through share buybacks than they were raising through IPOs and secondaries, which isn't what the stock market's there for at all. The stock market is there to provide appropriately priced risk capital so companies can grow, invest, hire more people and help things along, not shrink. But that is kind of what happened. And some data from Bloomberg here show that 2015 was the last year when companies raised more money than they actually handed back to shareholders through buybacks across the FTSE 100, which seems a bit... I know they're more mature companies, So you would say, well, they're not growing as fast, but nevertheless, I wouldn't view that as a really an affirmation of what stock markets are for. But that trend now seems to be coming to an end. And the other reason why we probably would expect to see more fundraising again is that debt's just gone through the roof over the last 10 years. Yeah. Not so much at small and mid-cap level, but at FTSE 100 level, net debt, according to data from Bloomberg here, £260 billion at the end of 2009 as we came out of the financial crisis. End of 2019, £457 billion.
Wow.
Yeah. So, okay, now that's fine. You can argue because interest rates are at record lows and not going up.
Yeah.
But at some stage, yeah, the ferryman needs to be paid, the debt needs to be paid back or rolled over, and you're still paying, even with interest rates being low, the interest bill has gone up because the debt position has gone up so much, and that is money that's just being paid in interest rather than being invested in a more productive fashion, dare one say. So I wouldn't be surprised to see a lot more fundraisings in the second half. Doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing for the stock market. And frankly, if you're an investor, it might mean you get a chance to pick up some stock that you like at a discount or at a relatively depressed price and tuck some away for the longer term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you know what? I'm just looking at Centrica's share price on a chart here.
That'd be ugly. That'd be ex-certificate stuff, I would think.
Yeah, 2014, it was £4 a share.
It's
now 48 pence a share, and that's with the uprising.
20% rise today. Yeah, really. Yeah.
But I'm thinking now, though, this could, I mean, you know, never call a bottom, of course, but I'd missed that Ian Cohen, the previous CEO, had stepped down, of course, because I'd always see him coming on TV doing an update, and there'd be pressure saying, oh, you're charging people too much.
Bills.
And he said, well, we haven't. But the share price has gone down and down. I thought, how long can he survive and hold on, this guy? But seems now they've come in, they seem to be doing stuff, don't they? Because that's what you want new management to do, is actually, it hasn't been working, do something to change the share price. You know? So they're doing something, aren't they? So, but the thing is,
I think Chris O'Shea is the new boss. He'd been the chief financial officer, but not for very long.
Yeah.
So from memory, he's not a company lifer. So he's come in and has provided that different perspective that you obviously felt was needed, because he's come in and he sold a big asset that people thought was pretty core to the business. So, you know, he's done something more dramatic in 5 months than Ian Conn did in 2 or 3 years, you could argue. So I think that, and that is what the share price needs. Yeah. You've still got lots of questions over the company. It's still incredibly complex. Energy supply in the UK, software and services and smart meters in the UK, exploration and production, nuclear facilities. But he is looking to simplify that. And, you know, lower debt is good. And I would genuinely argue that simplicity is good.
Yeah.
Because then, you know, and so I think 2 major steps towards putting a bottom under the share price and potentially giving it a more sustainable re-rating. I mean, the UK energy supply market, as we know, is still a fiercely competitive one, as you say. On pricing, you regularly hold up on radio and TV programmes to explain yourself or by politicians. You've got the regulator breathing at you. You've got customers who can change supplier relatively painlessly and easily. Now, Ofgem wants to see that, and they can. But equally, we have seen, 10, 15 alternative energy suppliers go broke over the last couple of years. So it's easing a little bit if you can tough it out. And it's starting through things like Hive.
Yeah.
About remote smart Internet of Things and smart meter platform. That is an interesting development because it helps make customers sticky and you're providing a little bit more value added. So there are some tentative rays of light there. But, you know, I still think, you know, you're going to have to be pretty brave to really start chasing this one, because it's, in the end, it's competitive. Its market is still extremely competitive. And you were to measure it on a sort of Porter's Five Forces basis, you know, it probably wouldn't still look so clever, but simplicity is good, lower debt is good, expectations are incredibly low, and if they can ever get themselves back onto the dividend list, then you might have something to start to work with, potentially.
Yeah, and do you know what? Even looking at the chart, even the jump today, there's been so many false dawns of this could be the bottom, and it's actually moved up across the 200-day moving average and then come back down and gone lower. It's done that several times.
It's been the ultimate value trap in some ways.
Yeah. So I wouldn't jump in yet, give it a lot of time. There's always more time, I think. It's like at the moment, we are looking...
Patience costs nothing. Fear of missing out is a frightening thing, but patience costs nothing.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I know we've seen, you know, some of the markets rise, but, you know, a lot of that, we said 22% of the S&P now is the big six, so that makes sense. But I just think we haven't really seen this. It's going to play out for a long time. And I think until... you know, furlough ends in this country, we won't know how many people really are unemployed because, you know, if there's no demand there to bring the workers back, then they're going to be laid off, aren't they? So we don't know what's happening yet. We've still got, you know, this hasn't played out yet. We've still not a vaccine. You know, this we've got reports of second wave surges. There's still a lot going on, isn't it? So patience is, you know.
Yeah, there is, and you know the S&P 500. I know it stumbled a little bit yesterday, but it's still what 7 or 8% higher than it was a year ago. Mm-hmm. And I find it pretty hard to believe that the world is 7 to 8% better off than it was a year ago. Well, America is, in all fairness. Mm-hmm. And I think that then you get back to spreadsheet boy here. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's something that we've discussed on this call that you know those big six American tech stocks, the FANMs. You know, Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, Alphabet, and Netflix, and so on, they basically provided all of the market cap gain in the last 12 months and more.
Yeah.
So it's been an incredibly narrow market. And I noticed that, you know, those stocks have sold off a little bit this week, you know, buying the rumor, selling the fact, the Q2 numbers, you know, Netflix sandbagged their Q3 forecast, but then they always do, so no big deal. We've got Apple, we've got Alphabet, we've got Facebook coming up next week. So that's going to be a really interesting test for a market that has been incredibly unbalanced. And you know, we talked about it before with the Nifty 50 back in the 1970s. Everybody was piling into those, well, roughly 50 stocks, thinking they were safe. But in the end, they became dangerous simply because their valuations were so, no matter how sound their business models were at the time, their valuations made them dangerous because they were so overextended and left you no margin for safety if anything went wrong. And so it'll be a really interesting test of these FANM stocks in the next 6 months, because you just haven't been seeing earnings forecast upgrades. The share prices have gone bananas, but you have not been seeing earnings forecast upgrades. And Apple's operating earnings, frankly, are not much higher than they were 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Earnings per share are, because of share buybacks and financial engineering. Yes, the service business is very strong, but if the service business is growing and strong, then the hardware business must be showing much lower profits. So it's not as straightforward as it seems. And you know, we've all seen Tesla's share price go tonto in the last 6 months or so. Those things just, you know, naturally make me nervous. I'm not saying that they can't keep going, but you know, if Tesla goes into the S&P 500, then the index crowd's going to get involved, and goodness knows what is going to happen.
Yeah.
But I think when you've got a market that is relying on so few stocks that look impregnable, but are on very high valuations, their valuations alone can make them dangerous. And you go back to the Nifty 50 and look at some of the names there, they were deemed to be impregnable at the time. Kodak, Polaroid.
Yeah, exactly.
They're dead, or as good as makes no odds. So yeah. I know that's over a long term, but hey, we're all investing for the long term in theory, right?
Yeah. No, do you know what? I genuinely still think, I say to people, look at businesses you like and wait
Correct.
For volatility. There will be a sell off. You know, there will. I think it could be quite a big sell off because we haven't seen one, and we're in very volatile times, you know, financially. But the markets haven't been just creeping a bit higher all the time, and so where's the volatility here? I think we're still going to. I don't think we're going to retest that bottom in March, but I think we'll go towards it again. I'm just waiting.
I think a lot of that will depend on the Fed's balance sheet, which is we've been tracking.
Stopped
growing. It sneaked up a tiny little bit last week. I haven't checked this week's data yet, but I think if the Fed does try and throttle back, then I think that could be a potential trigger point. Equally, it's just as likely to be something completely out of left field, because again, that's when you find out where your margin of safety is. And we saw with these FANG stocks, they all got clubbed like everything else back in February, March, because they were big, they were liquid, and people had profit to take there. So it's the old story. All correlations went to one really quickly.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I did download it this week, actually, the Fed stuff, and they sort of we peaked at in the 17th of June, pretty much. But last week, they did go up a little bit, not as much as the week before. They went up to $37 billion the week before.
Oh, so small.
And they were up $6 billion last week.
Oh, so it's flat, basically.
So, flat. So they haven't done a lot. So I think they're waiting until the market has a big scare again, sells off, and maybe they'll
start. That's my suspicion, too. Dry powder.
Yeah, marvellous. Have a nice weekend, Russ.
And you. Take care, mate. Look after yourself.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Hill, equity analyst and full-time investor. You all right, fella?
Yeah, morning, Justin.
Now, what's your thoughts on the market at the moment? I keep sensing that the market just needs to roll over a little bit, you know, doing cash buying.
Wasn't that a song?
Yeah, bro, I don't know.
Was it seven in a bed, roll over? It's almost a bit like that on the markets.
Well, in fact, you should say six in a bed, roll over.
Oh, it's like, six.
That's, no, because the big six, you know, I'm talking about the big sort of tech stocks, you know, that, yeah, exactly. Well, 22% of the S&P are now them, you know, the big FANG stocks plus Microsoft, so six in a bed, roll over, which is the one that's going to fall out of bed first, I think. And then
it did sort of slightly take some air out of the market this week. I mean, we had Microsoft producing some fantastic results and then decreasing. We've had a number of other tech stocks which have also done. And I saw an amazing stat where NASDAQ was now worth more than the entire GDP of the whole of the EU, which didn't actually happen ever before, even in sort of the dot-com frenzy. So we are getting a bit sort of like elevated in terms of valuations. And I mean, there's a couple of bellwethers to look at that just look ludicrous. I mean, we obviously take out sort of Tesla, but Zoom's on, last time I looked, was 38 times sales. And Nikola, which is basically hasn't even sold a single truck, which does gas and electric trucks, but tries to model itself on a sort of like a big rig type of equivalent for Tesla, is worth about 18 billion, hasn't even sold anything at all.
Yeah,
so
nuts,
yes, there's a bit of froth, and I think most sensible investors will steer well clear of those, but traders are loving it. I mean, if you look at like Tesla, for instance,
yeah.
I mean, that's just like killing the shorts. It's still heavily shorted, and at some point in time those guys have got to buy, and that's really what's happening. There's a massive fight between sort of like people are long and people are short.
Yeah, and the thing is though, I mean, you know, people said, oh, you can justify the market rising because of the big six, but I think what people understand, the market is connected, you know, and so, you know, most people don't just hold one stock. And so if they are, you know, they've got a big holding in, say, a Tesla or whatever, and that starts to fall off, people start to worry and start to sell, and it gets more selling, you know. And so it is a knock-on effect. So I think if we have one of these big tech stocks roll over, it does, you know, it does have, it's a domino effect a little bit, you know, because they do hold so much weight and so much presence in the market now. So I'm just waiting for that to happen. One of them's got to roll over sooner or later. Yeah, cool. Anyway, let's get on to small cap British stocks. What's any news out this week, Paul, you've been looking at?
Well, there's three stocks I absolutely follow, and they're all quality businesses. I mean, I have owned them in the past, but not at the moment. I mean, let's just kick off with the one I think you've talked about before, which is Tristel, which had a trading update a couple of days ago. And it came out with better than expected numbers. I mean, it blew the its analysts' expectations away, and the shares went down. I mean, that's a classic,
do you know what I thought?
Like, yeah, buy on the dip.
Yeah, well, do you know what I thought? I thought, hang on, I read the RNS about three or four times, and then, what am I missing here? Why is it dropping? And I know it's had a bit nice rise, and the one issue I thought was where their main business had taken a bit of a dip, but that's been more than made up for in the other part of the business, I thought. And I thought, what's the problem? So yeah, I see it as an opportunity. I mean, I don't hold any at the moment, but I see that as an opportunity. It's a good business, growing very well, isn't it?
Well, it's management team's excellent. Technology is IPR or patent protected until the earliest sort of like gets patent sort of like rolling over, so to speak, is 2028. So it's got a lot of IPR there, it's just been sort of, it's got two forces. The first one was all of its service cleaners were being used in hospitals, which had a huge boost on COVID-19 and will continue to do, and it's called its new cash range. And then the opposing force was that a lot of its Tristel wipes are used for elective procedures, and that sort of like shaved some of the sales off. But if you actually look at the numbers, I mean, I think sales were up 21%, of which only 3% was acquisition growth. 6%, if I remember correctly, was COVID. So, and the rest of it was basically, you know, like for like, genuinely organic. So that's 12% in total. So they did like for like. It's to say they make 30%, you know, sort of profit margins down the back. And the only thing which I think led investors to sell the stock was simply because they were sort of being slightly cautious on how quickly elective procedures would come back into their home territory, the UK, because they make good margins out of their Tristel wipes for sort of like ear, nose, and sort of like those type of procedures. So I think that's only it. And all I would say is that, you know, if they're lowering the bar going forward, then it's easy to get over for next year. I mean, I can't see hospitals reducing the need to for cleanliness in the near term. So I actually think they'll probably beat their, you know, the estimates on the table for this year. So I thought it was a very good set of results. Shares went down, and the reason why I sort of you know raise it to people is that, you know, it's a classic sort of buy on the dips, as you say. If it ever rolls over deep, I mean, it's still not trading exactly cheaply. I think it's about five times sales.
It's not cheap, is it? Well, so what? I'm interested. You always look at sales, don't you? I mean, that's a good thing, but I mean, I tend to also look at, with companies making a profit, looking at the profit. It's not cheap to pay that, is it? Pre-tax profit is 6.8, and what's the market cap there? Is 186, so a million.
Well, on broker estimates at around about sort of like, you know, £4.20, it's on sort of 20, it's on 35 times PE.
Exactly,
and probably around about 10 times EBITDA. Mm. But a sales is always a good one because it just gives you a feel of how, you know, how big the margins are.
And if you look at it, they've never seemed to have grown less than 20%. They are consistently growing at that 20% or more. They are a good growth stock. Like I said, now and again, it happens if it's growing, a company's growing and they're highly valued. They do take a knock sometimes, don't they, like this?
Another good investment lesson that you told me last week, which was your holding period for 100 baggers was going to be like 26 years. I did actually own these, and I had quite a big position probably about, I don't know, 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. At around about 30p, and I averaged out at around about £1.20, which was a nice full bagger. I, you know, made a lot of money out of it, so I can't complain. Hence the shares are now £4. So, you know, that would have been a good 10 bagger. But all I would say, excellent company, lots of IPR, well run, highly profitable, super cash generation. This is probably one of the top quality stocks you could possibly own on AIM. Yeah. And if it comes down, I would be buying a lot.
Do you know what? I often see people dissing AIM, saying they're all full of rubbish, non-profit, pre-revenue. I said, no, they're not at all. Maybe in the area you're looking at, or the people ramping on Twitter are generally dealing in pre-revenue resource stocks and bottom of the bucket. But there are some cracking companies in it. And this is one, like I say, it is generating good growth, you know, generating good cash. And there's plenty of stocks like this. You know, if you're talking about sort of in the triple digit market cap space, there are plenty of stocks on AIM like this. But I think...
Should we move on to another one?
Yeah, but the noise is generally down at the sort of sub 10 million, sub 20 million market cap with a resource companies that are not... probably will never generate cash, you know. But talk about another one. Go on, what's the next one?
Well, the other one is Blanco Technology. I mean, I've owned this twice in my history, okay? Owned it when it was called Regenesis back in 2006 and held it to about 2014 and sold out at a very good profit. And then I also owned it when owned about 2016 just before Christmas when I sold after about sort of 3 years in its new sort of formation, you know, called Blanco. And what this does is data erasure. That sounds dead easy, but it actually is really tough. So particularly if you're one of the large corporates, if you're sort of like, I don't know, a social media company or the size of, you know, sort of Intel or Microsoft or something like that, and somebody has GDPR and they say, I actually want to be deleted from your system, how'd you do that? You know, there's so many servers you're in for your personal data. So what you have is you have live erasure, which is super difficult, and they're one of the only people who can actually do it, i.e. without actually impacting having to recycle sort of, you know, physical recycling of servers, actually deleting off multiple sort of places within a whole sort of corporation. So they do live erasure, which is going like a gangbusters, and they also do like the physical disposal of the asset. They don't actually do the recycling, but they provide the software that allows what they call ITAD. That's IT asset disposal businesses who then do the recycling to then wipe those devices clean, like mobile, like PCs, all that kind of stuff. And they're the number one player in this by an absolute mile. They're sort of like five or six times bigger than any other player worldwide. So they are sort of like, they're actually, if you actually Google it, you know, their name is synonymous with data erasure. So this is really niche software with a really strong position. Again, admittedly, the shares are not cheap. They're on about 4x sales. But in my view, I mean, they could go a lot higher. One, because the like-for-like growth underlying the business is going to be double digits. And they will get to margins, I'm pretty sure, of 20% plus. And they currently are on about just under 10%. And that's because they're putting a lot of investment into their mobile position and to their other, you know, sort of like, you know, software, etc. As I say, I've owned this twice. Another very high-quality business run by a good management team, super cash generative. And the reason why it didn't go up after a trading statement this week was simply because it'd been temporarily hit by elongated sales purchased by its customers, as they weren't even in the office. So how can you make sales to these guys? But they've got a really high quality recurring revenue stream. I mean, the sales like for like didn't go down in the second half. They were actually slightly up. That shows you the resilience and the recurring nature of it. But I think they're going to go back to double digits. And once they do that, you're going to get that operating leverage and it's going to go up. And again, you know, I would alert investors to this one. Put it on your watch list. It's about a £150 million market cap. I've met the management team a lot. High drop-through rates, good cash conversion. You know, lots of, I mean, they are basically the biggest in this market by a mile. And it's a small market, but it's only going to grow. And the sort of things, the key growth drivers in it, digitization, I mean, hey, that's not going away soon, is it, because of COVID-19. You've got, obviously, we want to sort of like, you know, improve the quality of the world in terms of recycling and environmental protection. And this is right in there, and it's right in, you know, ECG. We're not going to sort of like stop cybercrime. I mean, that's really gone through the roof, and this is what this does. It protects people's data, disposes of it properly. So, you know, and corporates are moving to the cloud, which is what it's really tough to do. Deleting data from the cloud is really tough, and this is the only game in town if you want to do that. You know, so and they've got patents as well on some of their, you know, on their software. So everything's moving the right direction. All I'm saying is that if you get any type of sort of like, you know, swoon in these shares, I mean, I'm going to be buying a lot, and I've bought them already twice a lot over the last sort of like 15 years, because there aren't that many good quality businesses which go cheap like this business, you know.
Yeah. No, exactly. I mean, you've got to pay for quality. Like I said, that's the thing. They're not cheap. But I did do your thing there. I Googled data erasure. Now, at the top there with an ad is Blanco. I scroll down through the other ads, there's about four other ads, and top search there is Blanco. So organic and normal non-ad search,
yeah,
is Blanco.
Yeah, I'll tell you the other one which crops up a lot. It's called Kroll, yeah?
Yeah,
because they're usually right up there, and actually Kroll use Blanco software. They white label it.
Okay.
So they're usually the top three.
Yeah. So do you know what? I was thinking, what do they have as IP? So a lot of companies must have this, but the fact they come up naturally in number one in the Google search, and you say they got patents there, means. And of course, do you know what? It's like people think data erasure is easy. It's not. It's like if you erase data from anywhere, it's still there. You know, it's not erased properly. You've got to do it properly. IT experts can get that data back, you know, if they want to. So if you really want to erase data, you've got to do it properly by experts, and you can't just delete that email, it's gone. No, delete from the bin, it's gone. It's not.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. some of the biggest data breaches, particularly at the CIA, for instance, have all been because people have not wiped their drives properly, and they've got into the hands of organised criminals, and they've just basically reconstituted their hard drives, even though they thought they've actually been wiped. So yes, you've got to be super careful that you actually have an audited trail that you wipe clean your drive. I mean, you know, it isn't easy. One of the reasons why everybody has about five mobiles at home, because it ain't easy to do.
Yeah, cool. So they are two quality businesses. They're not cheap, but you've got to pay for quality. So what's the next? What's the third one?
The third one, well, that, again, a good quality business that is actually really well, you know, good value, which actually has been hit by, you know, COVID, is a company called VP, which is a plantire business, now specialist plantire business. And about 95% of its sort of profits are generated from the UK construction, home building and infrastructure business. And, you know, not surprisingly, why we've had a lockdown of sort of construction sites in March and April, and that reduced sales like for like by about 45%. They've now recovered over the last 3 months to less than, you know, sort of 20% down. So you're seeing a good, you know, good trajectory there.
And their again, their chart reminds me exactly of a house builder's chart, in pretty much. It's had that same kind of dip and bounce, and it's flattened out a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, but they don't do commodity side. I mean, they good make good margins. I mean, I think they're sort of like, you know, we're talking of low teens, 13, 14% EBIT margins. Return on capital employed is historically around about 14, 15%. So, it's cash generative on an underlying basis. So it's a high quality business. And all it is the shares have been knocked temporarily because of COVID. Now, it hasn't snapped back totally yet, but it will come over the next sort of 6 to 12 months. I mean, we've seen that this week. You know, the UK construction PMIs were really strong in June. I mean, they were the highest for 2 years. They went from sort of 29 to 55, and that's been reflected. If you were trying to actually do some DIY over the sort of lockdown period, then good luck with that, because trying to get some product out of, you know, online delivery from B&Q was near impossible because you couldn't even get on the website. I mean, they saw 200% increase in, you know, sort of home improvement work. You've seen that gain this morning in, you know, sort of Safestar with sort of like new, they sell doors and windows. So the construction sector, house building sector and infrastructure sector are all coming back slightly on different timelines. But you push the clock forward into sort of 6 months time by the end of the year. I mean, I can certainly see 2021 being not totally back to normal, but you could see, particularly if we get a vaccine, which I think we will, or a good therapeutic. And these are going to benefit. And just to give you an indication, I mean, the shares are sort of like, if you wanted to buy them, they're about £7.50 at the moment. They're only on about sort of like they're only on about sort of less than six times EBITDA, and if you do it on a sort of like on a PE ratio, it's on about eight times. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and they've historically played a good dividend. They're owned by, or is sort of a family trust, the Pilkington family, out of half of the shares are out of Harrogate, and because they've got such a heavy ownership, I mean, that they take ultra care over the business's development and strategy. They started it. And absolutely, you know, these guys are not, they're going to be super careful when it comes to sort of managing shareholder money. So, you know, you can, if you don't want to sort of like go for sort of like, these are about, they're not AIM, they're about 250 market million market cap. They're on the small cap main listing. But I can certainly see these guys getting back to normal, really, is by the end of certainly next year. Now, I ran a downside scenario last night, okay? Assuming they only really get back in 2023, mm-hmm. 2 years afterwards, yeah. And I'm still getting a valuation of over £8. So, you know, when you look at it sort of like it through that lens, you say, well, with shares are currently trading at £7.50, downside scenario is £8. The shares have been trading at around about sort of £11-12 before the pandemic hit. You can see, well, I've actually got significant upside there. And little downside, even if there's even in a down, you know, in a worst case scenario. So, you know, put it this way, I would be buying a lot. The reason why I haven't is because I'm already in, as you know, in this sector, in equipment rental, with quite a big position in a smaller player called Northbridge. So mm-hmm. I don't want to get overexposed on equipment hire, but hey, this is a quality business. It's demonstrated that in the past. It did pretty well during the great financial crisis, came back, you know, pretty quickly. And I'll just say, you know, I just think these look cheap, you know.
Yeah.
But hey, all three of those I'd stick on your watch list, and they're good businesses, no doubt. I've spoken to the management team lots of occasions, and I've been impressed.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? Is that thing again from last week? That 100 baggers. Tenny, owner operated companies tend to vastly outperform the broad stock market by apparently 7% or more annually. So it's always good to have family in there, isn't it? Know the business, hold a lot of stock. You know, it's
Oh yeah. I mean, and also the managers have been there for a long period. They know what, you know what to do. And what's quite interesting, they're pretty modest in terms of how they actually present themselves. I mean, they've been doing masses in terms of digitization of this whole construction area. Mm-hmm. And they haven't been shouting about it like many of their competitors. They've just been getting on and doing it. And if you actually look at the comparative multiples, and the main competitors are people like HSS and Speedy Hire, and they blow them away in terms of margins and return on capital employed and long term shareholder return. So because they've got that really good sort of family and board custodial type of relationship, they don't do things which are just like fly by night stuff. That they do things because they think they really are the right things to do.
Yeah, cool stuff. I didn't really know anything about them. I'm not.
People don't. I mean, as I say, they don't get that much sort of media coverage, but I would definitely look at it. Well, they are specialists. Yeah. I mean, we're talking specialist, sort of like, plan tire businesses. It's good margins. They are sort of like, pretty much in there as sort of like the number one or number two in their particular sectors of the equipment rental businesses.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to have stocks that nobody know about. I mean, the downside is sometimes the spread can be big. Like, looking now, the bid is £7, the ask is £7.56. They've had no volume today, and we're like, what? Come up to, 11 o'clock in the morning, and volume, so, yeah.
They had quite a few about 2 days ago, so, you know. You have to choose your days, I would agree, yeah. The thing is, with the family ownership, and what happens is that people buy these shares and sit on for years because there's no way they're going to sell them. They know which direction it's going, mm-hmm. longer term.
Marvellous stuff, Paul. Thanks for that, fella. And we'll speak you next week.
Yeah, cheers, Justin.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Avacta Group, down 1.5% to 130. At four, Greatland Gold, down 3.2% to £13.65. At three, Synergen, up 7.5% to £2.01. At two, Canadian Overseas Petroleum. Is that still around? Down 1.25% to £0.395. And at one, Symphony Environmental, again, cracking RNS from them yesterday, up 1.9% to 27 pence. Having said that, I did do 200% yesterday, came back to about 80% up. So some people trading that. I'm a holder. I didn't trade it. I'm not a dirty trader. I'm a holder. I'm an investor. I'm a clean, honest, upstanding investor. Not a dirty, downright trader. Okay. Top five most liked or most read RNS is as follows. Anglo-Pacific Group, half year 2020 trading update. At four, Jangada Mines, update on investment in Fodir Titanium. At three, Vitaply or BP polymetallic mine update. That's from Vast Resources. At two, Integumin Labskin launches remote clinical skin trials. And at one, Thor Mining, positive test results from Kapunda Copper ISR project. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.